Any preliminary questions or issues? Results. I'm guessing in about a week. So, depends on how this weekend goes. I did. It will. I'm actually going to post it online, and I'm making a copy of the. I actually filmed it, so I'm gonna. If the DVD turns out, I just burned it this morning. Special edition, yeah. It's the collector's edition. Then you could actually check it out, and there are a couple of DVD players in the law school library that work, so you could watch that if you want. Particularly, whoever finds out that their exam was the one that I'll see if I'll have anyway. Other questions or issues? All right. Well, we finished yesterday, sort of finished. The material on loss of a chance, and again, it's to sort of summarize that the question for the courts is whether to extend loss of a chance, which has been recognized in the medical malpractice context, to other areas, and in effect, you'd have to find some similar. Policy reason, and I think in the long run, if the courts do more with loss of a chance, they're going to have to explain why you use it on the plaintiff's behalf, but you don't do a similar reduction on the defendant's behalf for the probability that the accident might have happened anyway. Remember, Mrs. Reynolds operating with an on-off switch, as it were. If Mrs. Reynolds satisfies us that her fall down the stairs was a result of negligence, she gets a full recovery, even though she acknowledges, yeah, I might have fallen anyway. If you're going to do a sort of parallel loss of a chance for the defendant, you should reduce the plaintiff's recovery by the probability that it would have happened anyway. So again, that's kind of a conceptual problem with laws of a chance. But from your perspective as a functioning lawyer, on the exam, as you look at a potential loss of a chance argument, the first thing you want to do is figure out, do I have a situation where the loss of a chance doctrine would do me any good? And it would do you some good if your situation was one in which the defendant took away a chance of recovery or a chance of avoiding the accident, but the likelihood from the evidence is it probably would have happened anyway. Under those circumstances, applying loss of a chance would be, in effect, getting this discounted value of the chance of avoiding the accident, whereas a traditional rule would say, if the evidence shows that the accident probably would have happened anyway, you have failed the but-for cause test. If that's your fact pattern, and more students, I would say, see it where it isn't there than fail to see it when it is there. But if you have a loss of a chance situation, then you ask the question, will a court, as I say, extend the loss of a chance doctrine from medical malpractice to some other area, or will it, like the court in Hardy, say, no, it works in the medical area, but it doesn't work here? You may be interested, by the way, that as we often talk about parallels between medicine and law, what happens in the legal context when there's malpractice by a lawyer where there is a chance of recovery, which is true of most personal injury cases, but the lawyer, through malpractice, loses that chance. Suppose, for example, the plaintiff has a personal injury case, brings it to a lawyer, the lawyer negligently marks down the time when the statute of limitations will run, doesn't file the action in time, the statute of limitations bars the claim. How do the courts handle loss of a chance by a lawyer? It turns out they say doesn't apply. And it doesn't apply for this reason, that when you have a legal malpractice case, you have what's called a case within a case, sort of like, as you may recall, in Hamlet, when Rosencrantz and Guildenstern put on the plays, the thing in which to catch the conscience of the king. They have a little play see if Hamlet's uncle responds in a guilty fashion. Well, in a legal malpractice case, you try the case of malpractice, that is, did the lawyer blow the statute of limitations, and you also try the underlying case. You put it to the jury, okay, here's the case, do you think the plaintiff should recover, so that the analysis in the legal context is that, unlike medicine where there are no do-overs, can't do a mulligan in medicine, you can do it in law, where in effect we could try the case as though the statute of limitations hadn't run. It's somewhat unrealistic in the sense that the defendant in such a case, the lawyer, is not the original defendant. The original defendant, who faces no liability, who might have put on a better case had the statute of limitations not been run, had it not run, in a legal malpractice case, the defendant essentially says, I don't care, I don't have a dog in this fight, as the saying goes. And so that defendant will, continuing with the canine analogy, roll over and play dead. And the lawyer, in effect, is trying to say, no, put on a better case. My negligence in letting the statute of limitations run didn't really cause any injury here because my plaintiff had, so to speak, a dog of a case. In any event, so that's the justification, such as it is, why lawyers apply this principle to cases of medical malpractice, but they don't apply the same principle to legal malpractice. Okay, now we find the third exception to our ordinary burden of proof on the burden we place upon the plaintiff, that the plaintiff has to establish that but for the defendant's negligence, the plaintiff would have avoided injury. And this third exception is the so-called, I call it multiple redundant causes, but courts usually refer to this as those cases involving the substantial factor test. So can somebody tell us about Purcell? Mr. Reich. Mesothelioma is the cancer of the lining of the lungs, and unlike lung cancer itself, where the lung is the site of the cancer, mesothelioma is almost exclusively related to asbestos exposure. So cases involving mesothelioma, unlike ordinary lung cancer, can essentially be medically diagnosed as an asbestos-caused disease. Okay. Okay. So all of that establishes that the defendants negligently exposed the plaintiff to these asbestos fibers. Okay? And let's assume for our purposes that the plaintiff can satisfy our Chapter 1 concern that they breached a duty they owed to the plaintiff. What's the Chapter 2 problem that we have? Yeah, that last part is the significant part. Whether the Chapter 2 issue is, did the defendant's negligence cause the plaintiff's injury? And each defendant essentially says, I'm entitled to be treated on my own. That is, the jury must find with respect to me, defendant one, along, you know, with the other 11 defendants, did my negligence cause the plaintiff's injury? And ordinarily, the way we define that question or the way we explain that question is we say that the defendant's negligence caused the plaintiff's injury if what? What's our ordinary explanation of that test? Okay, so the defendant says, in order to find me liable, in order to find that my negligence caused the plaintiff's injury, the jury would have to find, more probably than not, that but for my negligence, the plaintiff would not have been injured. And the defendant says, I don't think the plaintiff can prove that. And the plaintiff says, I don't think I can prove that either. Why not? And it doesn't even have to be the cause. I can't even say it was a cause in the sense that take out, let's assume all of these defendants contributed equally to the plaintiff's exposure. Each of them deposited 1/12 of the asbestos fibers in his body. And then the question is, if you take away that 1/12 of the exposure, would he have avoided mesothelioma? I don't think I can say that more probably than not. If that were the test, if each defendant's liability depended upon a finding that if you extracted this defendant's contribution, there would have been no injury, you would go to each defendant one by one and say, well, this one didn't make any difference. That one didn't make any difference. This one didn't make any difference. And finally, we come to the end and we say, I guess nobody made a difference here. In criminal law, you have the same kind of situation. Suppose seven gangsters line up at the Valentine's Day massacre or whatever. They have, you know, the victim, and they all fire their guns at the plaintiff and put a bullet in in his head or in his heart or some important location. And each of them says, well, gee, you know, we all fired on the count of three, 1, 2, 3, bang. Hey, even if I hadn't shot the guy, he was going to be just as dead. You can't say my criminal act caused this guy's death because, in effect, my behavior's wouldn't have made a difference. The answer in criminal law is to say, we have a principle for guys like you. We'll, we will still hold you liable for murder on this different test, the so-called substantial factor test. And what does the court do here with respect to asbestos cases? Okay, and what is the test that the jury will use to evaluate whether or not any of these defendants will be held liable? Again, assuming the evidence is clear that they all breached a duty toward the plaintiff, still, in order to hold a defendant liable, the jury has to make what finding? Yes, that it's a substantial factor in causing the plaintiff's disease. Different test, notice. And in this way, you may recall, this was the test the plaintiff liked and got a majority of the court to approve in Mitchell versus Gonzalez. They threw out the old proximate cause test and substituted the substantial factor language. The difficulty, of course, with the substantial factor language is, well, what does that mean exactly? It's an undefined term. I know what a but-for cause is, a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. Applying it may be tricky in fact situations, but at least the concept is clear. Asking the jury to make a determination that this was a substantial factor is a more challenging assignment. Now, you pointed out that the doctor said that the exposure that would trigger mesothelioma may require, what did he say? Yeah. In fact, the late Stephen Jay Gould, the paleontologist, baseball guy, and so forth, Stephen Jay Gould died of mesothelioma, and his only exposure, so far as we can tell, was that the specimen drawers for his fossils. He worked in the Museum of Natural History in New York, and all the years that he, as a paleontologist, he went around, you know, but they were lined with asbestos. And apparently that was enough to trigger the disease. Women whose husbands worked in the construction business as insulators, they're down sawing these blankets of asbestos insulation and mixing up cement with asbestos fibers. The women who were married to guys who worked in this business got asbestos because they laundered their husband's shirts. And that exposure apparently was enough in some people to trigger asbestos. Their husbands, by contrast, many of them who were, you know, eating it for lunch, in effect, didn't get it. You know, it's the mystery of you know, cancer and carcinogenic exposure and risk factors. It's a very unpredictable business. But, again, if the testimony is that a single exposure is enough, then we could say that a modest exposure is a substantial factor in causing the disease. The pure theoretical analogy, I think, to this, as I mentioned Murder on the Orient Express. I've seen that on TV recently, by the way, if you be playing it on the American Movie Channel. It's an old Agatha Christie novel turned into a cameo. There are all kinds of famous actors and actresses in the Murder on the Orient Express, but the plot line centers around this guy who's found murdered, and of course Inspector Poirot goes around being his detective self, and in the end he finds out that there are 12 different people who all had it in for the murder victim, and each of them in their own different way. You know, one poisoned him, one stabbed him, you know, they all did different things. To make it perfectly analogous, you could have the victims drink And then each of the 12 people puts a dose of strychnine or cyanide or something into the drink sufficient to cause the death. So each of them in sequence puts it in, and then you can say each of them was sufficient to cause the injury, but none of them by themselves made a difference. Again, though, the criminal law principle is to say that's still murder. All 12 of them murdered the guy, even though each of them could claim my behavior, you know, if I chose, and suppose nobody knew, you had two little vials here, and or, you know, you went in secret and you either put the drop in or you didn't put the drop in and no one else would know. Again, you can play with that for a while. The point being that to the extent that you do something which cumulatively is sufficient to cause the injury, multiple redundant causes then our traditional rule of requiring but-for causation will be replaced as a principle of justice to avoid the injustice of letting all these people go free, letting all the asbestos manufacturers blame everybody else, and no one is available for imposition of liability. The court says, no, we're not going to have that. We'll use this different test. But notice that the triggering phenomenon that invokes this doctrine is, as I suggest, multiple redundant causes. They pile on where one or more by itself would be sufficient, and the defendant's argument would be, but for this principle, the defendant's argument would be, I'm redundant. I make no difference. I'm not a but-for cause. Mr. Edwards.
It's like on
the end,
one by itself.
Yes. Right. Then each would be a but-for cause. In other words, let's suppose that the fatal dose of asbestos is 1,200 fibers. And with 1,199, you live happily ever after. Only at 1,200, and then you're dead. Okay, and let's suppose each of them puts in 100 fibers. It's exactly evenly divided. Each of them then is a but-for cause. If that were the evidence, the plaintiff wouldn't need a variation from the test, because the plaintiff can say, if only any one of you had used reasonable care, and my client had only gotten 1,100 fibers instead of 1,200 fibers, he'd be alive, living happily ever after. But because you negligently gave him 100 fibers, I can say that to each one of you. Each of you was sufficient. I mean, each of you was a but-for cause. If it helps, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, think of it in terms of an electrical circuit, a light bulb, so to speak, going on. There's a difference between the kind of light switch where any one of them by themselves, if you switch it on, will turn the light on, as opposed to one where they're arranged so that any one of them, if you turn it off, that will turn the light off. A but-for cause is one which controls things. If I turn this off, the light doesn't go on. If I use reasonable care, the plaintiff doesn't suffer the injury. Suppose, for example, in a hypothetical, you have two radiologists whose job it is to read a chest x-ray. I got, you know, lung breathing discomfort. I go to my doctor. My doctor arranges to have a chest x-ray taken. The chest x-ray is sent to a radiologist. The radiologist reads it, doesn't see any evidence of lung cancer, but passes it along to a second radiologist. Suppose the family doctor who takes the chest x-ray looks at it and says, gee, I don't see any problem here, but just to be sure, I'll send it to the radiologist. Radiologist looks at it, he doesn't find anything. turns out they both acted negligently. Both of them should have detected on my chest x-ray that I have lung cancer, and because they fail to spot this, I miss out on a window of opportunity to avoid the disease. They're both but-for causes, because if my family doctor had acted with reasonable care, I wouldn't be injured. If the radiologist had acted with reasonable care, I would not have been injured. I don't need an exception to the rule. Both are but-for causes. By contrast, let's suppose I'm allergic to some medication and Dr. A gives me penicillin. Dr. B doesn't know I've already gotten penicillin or wants to give me an extra dose just to be sure. Dr. B gives me penicillin as well. I'm allergic to penicillin. The amount they've both given me would kill me. It does kill me. In that case, there are multiple redundant causes. Each one could say, hey, whether I gave it to him or not, if the other guy gave it to him, he's just as dead. My conduct is not a but-for cause. So again, depending upon what the facts are, do I need an exception to the rule, or can I prove my case, an ordinary case of but-for causation, by showing the failure of the defendant to use reasonable care made a difference? You could have thrown the switch to turn off the, you know, the juice that was going to come around and bite me. Or is it a case in which even if I use reasonable care, the plaintiff's probably going to be injured anyway because I'm doing something just like a whole bunch of other people, and what those other people did are would be sufficient to cause the injury. Another common situation is somebody goes bar hopping. They stop at Tavern A, consume 3 alcoholic drinks. They go to Tavern B, they consume 3 alcoholic drinks. They go to Tavern C, another 3. Tavern D, another 3. They get out on the highway, they cause an accident. Which of those bars is liable? Any bar who served him after he was legally intoxicated. Even though the bar might say, and it might be the bar only serves 1 drink, and the other serves 3, and the other one serves 6. But I served this guy when I shouldn't be serving him, and that's part of what contributes to his, you know, 0.18 blood alcohol content at the time the accident occurs. Again, if I'm the plaintiff and I'm in that situation where I'm afraid the defendant might say, my conduct is redundant. You're right, he showed up at my bar drunk. He left my bar drunk. Is that a problem? Did I make a difference? It's your burden to show that but for my serving him that one beer, this accident wouldn't have happened. I say, no, that's not my burden if I'm the plaintiff. I say my burden is to show that it's a substantial factor. One drink was a substantial factor in that. We know that his drunkenness, that his intoxication caused the accident. That's an easy case to prove. The harder case to prove is what's the role of this drink, that drink, in producing the intoxication. And at that point, the plaintiff's going to say, I want the substantial factor test, not the but-for test, because the bar hopping case is like asbestos. We're not sure exactly at what point you move from being okay to not being okay, and because of the difficulty of doing that, we're going to use a multiple redundant cause test. Yeah. Well, part of it is our sort of scientific limitation. As with asbestos, I mean, maybe someday we'll find out that if you have this gene this constellation of genes and you're in this kind of environment, you have this risk factor for asbestos. or for smoking, causing cancer. Again, these carcinogens affect people in different ways. Some people smoke 3 packs of cigarettes, and die, being shot by a jealous husband. Some people have secondhand smoke and are dead of lung cancer at age 38. People vary from case to case dramatically. Maybe someday we'll know whether this caused your disease, but at the moment we're stuck sort of with a much more uncertain case. And again, if the plaintiff correctly identifies the case as one in which you have multiple redundant causes, multiple exposures to asbestos, multiple servings of alcohol, each of which is negligent, each of which contributed but in an unknown way to the total injury, the plaintiff may persuade us it's time to use the substantial factor test, because in the absence of the substantial factor test, the plaintiff could easily fail to persuade the jury that it's a but-for cause. Mr. Brecht? Yes. The first, if you start the evening, you start your alcohol consumption at 7 p.m. at Tavern A, and the first 3 drinks are served to you when you are still legally entitled to be served. That's not negligent. It does, in effect, causes the later intoxication, but the bar owner who serves, the tavern owner who serves the driver, is not acting negligently until such time as the person is visibly intoxicated. Right. Correct. Yeah, they're not liable. The other bars who served after the point of visible intoxication are the ones who are on the hook. Yeah. We assumed that to start with, that the asbestos manufacturers had knowledge about. In fact, as it turns out, we'll read more about this in Chapter 3 under damages, punitive damages. It turns out that the asbestos manufacturers not only knew about the dangers of asbestos. In fact, asbestos is this sort of diabolically wonderful stuff. From the time of the Greeks, I forget, 400 BC or something like that, this sort of fibrous rock which doesn't burn, and it's fiber, it's sort of, you can weave this stuff sort of. It's really cool, and that's why it's used in such things as brakes and high heat insulation situations where you need something that's insulating properties, but you don't want it to be combustible. We still use asbestos on our brakes, folks, because it's irreplaceable. It's this great stuff. And so from the time they began mining the product, they knew that people who worked around it got the disease. And so the people who made it in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, which generated the exposure that led to all the claims, not only did they know about it, but the doctors who tried to warn people about it were sabotaged. They were attacked by the industry, and it was sort of like Ralph Nader and the and General Motors. The story, General Motors tried to catch Ralph Nader in a compromising situation, did all these other sort of dirty tricks. Because Nader was such a thorn in their side. So again, the negligence of the defendants in selling this product without warning about its dangers is pretty clear. The problem is the causation issue. What's the relationship between that and their disease? Okay, there are other things. So you started to talk about in Purcell about fine-tuning, what do we mean by a substantial exposure? You know, is it enough to drive by the plant where the asbestos is being used? Do you have to actually work in proximity? What degree of, you know, if you're there for half a day, is that enough? Again, the court has to find some threshold to say which of the many manufacturers of asbestos have sufficient exposure to generate a jury verdict. Another question, just so we're clear about this, how does this differ from Sindel? Right. So in Sindel, only one of them, essentially, if you go back to the firing squad analogy, in the firing squad analogy, there's only one bullet in the executed man's body. That's Sindel. There's only one person who caused the injurious shock. Whereas here, each of them put a little bit in play, and so again, it's a multiple redundant cause as opposed to the inability to identify a single person who caused the injury. Yeah. That becomes essentially a Chapter 6 issue, which, as it turns out, in Washington, they have a special rule for hazardous substances. So whereas they treat ordinary cases under a rule of individual percentage liability, where it's a hazardous substance, you become jointly and severally liable. So again, in Chapter 6, we start to play with this idea of should the defendants be liable for the whole injury, or should they be only accountable for their individual allocated share. Yeah. No. What we're saying is each one has to be a substantial factor, and we don't know. Again, it may make a difference if a single exposure is sufficient to cause the disease. That's a very strong case to say that single exposure is a substantial factor. Again, we don't know for individuals what the threshold is. Some may be exposed to 10,000 fibers and not get the disease. Some people have 50 fibers and they get the disease. So we don't know. But let's assume we did know what it was. Suppose it took 500 fibers to cause the disease. If you expose somebody to 30 of them, is that a substantial exposure? I don't know. Again, the jury would have to at some point make that judgment call, and that's what the court's wrestling with in part in Purcell. And only sort of in passing do they say, oh, by the way, we employ a substantial factor test. Okay, any other questions about substantial factor test? Again, you want to see if you can identify and go back, again, using prior exams to test yourself as to whether or not you're correctly identifying those cases where it's a Sindel-type case or a Summers versus Tice-type case or you know, which exception to but-for cause applies, if any at all. And as I say, more students tend to see it where it isn't there. It's a problem I have more frequently than that students fail to see it when it is there. So make sure you're correctly, or make sure you're evaluating the facts carefully before you immediately assume, oh, well, this is a case in which I would want to use alternative liability or some other theory. Okay, so that puts the finishing touches, hopefully, on the first section of Chapter 2. Again, the issue to date has been one of but-for causation. Under what circumstances can the plaintiff meet that test? Under what circumstances do we say, well, no, the plaintiff can't meet that test, but we're going to substitute a different test because justice requires it? When we shift now to talk about legal cause, as I said at the very beginning of the chapter, we're looking at a different kind of question. We're assuming for purposes of discussion that the plaintiff can meet the but-for cause test. The problem that we have in this section is, should liability be imposed on the defendant for this particular case? And what we're, the terminology we use to try to capture this other question is in the jury instruction that says, a proximate cause is one which in a natural and continuous sequence, that there is a sort of logical connection. As Justice Kennard said in Mitchell versus Gonzalez, the evaluation of legal cause is a normative, evaluative one. We're trying to decide what should be, not so much what is or what was. Is it fair to make a convenience store pay for injuries caused when a minor purchases alcohol and then gives it to his friends? Is it fair to make a garage liable for injuries caused when a car is stolen from that garage and runs over somebody? Is it fair to make somebody pay for an injury caused by speeding when the speeding seems to be a chance factor rather than one which actually made the injury more likely? Should we extend liability to somebody who ties up a boat at a dock if that boat bounces off of another boat and through a curious set of coincidences winds up getting wedged underneath a bridge that hasn't been raised and flooding occurs? The question of whether it's fair to impose liability is, as I say, a different question from saying, well, whose asbestos caused this guy's harm? Whose DES resulted in this woman's injury? It's not so much a factual question, it's a question about fairness. And we'll see competing evaluations. Because it's a normative evaluative question, we have to anticipate that people with different normative concepts or different perspectives will wind up coming reaching different conclusions. And that, again, is your job as a lawyer, is to try to anticipate what's the likely outcome of this question. Okay, so our first case is Berry versus Sugarnotch. We'll only have a chance to kind of get started with Berry here. I'll have to pick it up more next week, but we might as well get rolling, so to speak. Get this train on the track. Mr. Harris, go ahead and tell us about it. Okay, and I have to do a little kind of transposition here so that it's more congruent with the other issues that we've talked about. Let's assume for purposes of discussion that the motorman, or that a passenger was injured, and the passenger is suing the trolley company, alleging that the motorman's negligence in traveling above the speed limit caused their injury. The the plaintiff's argument is that it did cause the injury. How so? Okay, so we clearly would meet the but-for cause test. But for this guy's speeding, he would not have been at the place where the tree fell on him. On the other hand, the motorman argues that his negligence didn't cause the accident. Why not? I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And therefore, he says, the law does not operate on the basis of fortuity. The law operates on some sort of, again, normative value to some sort of moral basis. It's your fault for being there. Now, the court has in mind a different hypothetical situation in which his negligence would have been properly blamed for the accident. How so? Okay, so if he runs into the tree, the court says, then he's liable, but if the tree falls on him, he's not liable. What's the difference? How so? What's the difference in causation between the tree falling on him and running into the tree? There is a difference, by the way. Ms. Katsuela? Okay, well, the distinction is not so much that the tree falling is as unforeseeable if it falls on him as if it falls in front of him. Let's assume the trolley is such that traveling at 12 miles an hour, by the time the tree falls, he doesn't have time to stop. It's not that once the tree falls, he's negligent in failing to apply his brakes. There's nothing he can do at that point. But why is his speeding a cause of running into the tree, but it's not a cause of being caught? What's that? Why not? But it is a cause of his smashing into it. Yeah. Okay, and that's not true of running into it. What we're saying is there's a relationship between the speeding and running into trees, which is not true of speeding and having trees fall on you. The faster you go, the more trees you're going to run into. But the faster you go doesn't affect the likelihood, as you point out, going faster would have put him in yet a different place. That is a random event. The tree falling on him, whereas it's not a random event because the faster you go, the more trees you're going to hit. It increases your stopping distance. So again, going 200 miles an hour, he gets hit by just as many trees as going 2 miles an hour. But going 200 miles an hour means that he runs into a lot more trees than if he's going 2 miles an hour. So even though the but-for cause is just as true in this case as it would be of running into the tree, but for his speed, no accident, the court says, oh, that's a clever argument. Sophistical, they say. Remember the sophists who Plato always had to contend with, Socrates had to contend with. And the sophists had these clever arguments, they just weren't true. And so this one is a sophistical argument. It's clever, but it's not true. The law doesn't work that way. It's not on the basis of fortuity. The law has a sort of if not moral component to it, at least it expresses some kind of value. Speeding causes accidents. It doesn't cause trees falling on you. And unless the law reflects some kind of sense that this is what we care about, this reflects our values, simply to have it work like a lottery system, we can't go for that. Okay, so we'll pick up with Channel versus Mills, same basic concept on Monday.